From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the weeks after Mitt Romney lost to President Obama, journalist McKay Coppins says Republican Party leaders ordered a kind of autopsy. They wanted to know what it was that had killed their chances of winning. And they concluded mainstream American voters, particularly young people, had come to see the party as old and out of touch, and that the only way to appeal to these voters would be to moderate their positions on issues like immigration and same-sex marriage. But Coppins writes in a new book that what he calls the guerrilla freedom fighters of the party's conservative movement had a different idea, one that was in fact the polar opposite of moderation and accommodation. Coppins is joining us today to talk about what he's discovered about the Republican Party's fractious efforts to get back into the White House. Join us after the news.
Still thinking about that conversation on StoryCorps? Or the story you caught last weekend on Snap Judgment? The voices you hear on public radio stay with you. You can have a lasting effect on public radio, too. KUER sustainers give ongoing monthly contributions, providing a steady stream of income so we can continue to bring you the programs you can't get out of your head. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. McKay Coppins says the Republican Party was thrust into the wilderness on election night in 2012. That was when, of course, Mitt Romney lost to President Obama. And in fact, that's the name of his new book, The Wilderness, which he borrows from the story of Moses leading his people to the promised land. Republicans on election night, he says, found themselves without a standard bearer. And for the first time in more than 40 years, they had no heir apparent. So, as Coppins puts it, they had been consigned now to a period of indefinite wandering. He says, instead of one clear leader, they had an unruly cast of self-styled tablet-toting prophets, each with his own vision for the party's future. Today in the program, McKay Coppins is joining us to talk about his book, where he searches for the inside story into the party's quest to take back the White House. We invite you to join the conversation if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. McKay Coppins is a senior political writer at BuzzFeed News. He covers national politics, the Republican Party, and the conservative movement. He's joining us today from a studio in New York City. That's where he's based. And McKay Coppins, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let me begin. I guess I want to begin with your introduction, because there's the scenario you set up. You kind of take us forward in time, not far, but to October of this year and to that first debate, as you're imagining it, between the Republican and Democratic nominees for president. Explain why you did that. I guess you were trying to convey the stakes for this race.
Right. I mean, I hesitated to begin a book that is, you know, very rigorously reported with a hypothetical and imagined scenario. But I did feel like it was important, just because the stakes are incredibly high in this election. They're high in every presidential election, but especially for the Republican Party. I really feel, after spending all this time reporting and out on the campaign trail, like this is a historically pivotal moment for the party. You said in your intro, there's no next in line standard bearer, which is unique for the Republican Party. They almost always kind of nominate the runner up or the heir apparent for their presidential candidate. But beyond that, we're at a time of uncommon upheaval in American life, from issues like race and social justice, income inequality, immigration. We really are facing a lot of incredibly, high stakes issues and decisions. And what happens? The person that the Republican Party nominates will stand on a stage this fall with Hillary Clinton, most likely Hillary Clinton. And that debate, these debates tend to, and debate her on these very high stakes, important issues in America. And what I wanted to do in this book is not only look at the Republican Party as an institution, kind of its quest for the White House, but also some of the high-level players and candidates and what brought them to this point and what their worldviews are and how they view these issues and why they view them that way. And that's kind of what I tried to examine, and that's why I fast-forwarded to this moment that hasn't yet happened.
I wonder if you were – I'm just trying to imagine you over the past 6 months as you're putting, you know, this book to bed – And the race remains incredibly fluid. Let's talk about Bobby Jindal for a moment. I mean, in November, right. He backs out, and you spend a decent amount of time with him in the book, which is not to say that was wasted time. I mean, it seemed in some ways Jindal's story is a telling illustration of the fortunes of the party, but that must have been difficult to see, you know, Rand Paul, his fortunes go up and then he sort of goes down and the libertarian strain of Republican Party goes up and goes down. And I mean, what was that like trying to cover this moving target?
I haven't told this to anyone yet, but I actually got a call from Bobby Jindal just a week ago where we were kind of catching up, and he also kind of apologized to me for dropping out 2 weeks before my book came out. but I mean, I think it's true. I mean, look, I knew, you know, as I kind of set out to write and report this book, I obviously wanted to focus on people who I thought would be relevant, you know, when it came out, kind of in the middle of this primary season. But I also knew that there was a chance that I couldn't guess perfectly, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And as it turns out, no one could have guessed quite where we would end up now. But yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, look, it was like a little, anxiety-inducing as I watched the up and down of the polls and the various news cycles, but I do think that this book, and I tried to write this book in a way that, you know, had a shelf life that would go beyond the Iowa caucuses,
yeah,
right? Because of the like I said, where the party is, and also because I think that a lot of these figures, wherever they end up, whether they end up on the ticket or not, come this July at the convention, they're still emblematic figures for the party, and their stories still tell a lot about the kind of civil war that the party finds itself in. And that's ultimately what I had to decide, you know, which figures are most emblematic of these issues I want to explore and whose ideologies and ideas are most interesting. And Rand Paul, you know, somebody I also spent a lot of time writing about. I thought the libertarian kind of insurgency that looked ascendant for a while and now looks much less so in the party still is fascinating and something that the party is going to continue to grapple with through the election year and beyond.
Well, no doubt. And it's also really interesting, which we'll get to, his relationship with his fathers. As you put it, he has daddy issues. And that's really interesting in the sense that – and you do this in all of the players, at least I think most of the players. It's a little kind of mini biography that gives us a sense of their sensibilities and their disposition. So I want to break that down as we go. But let's talk about that sort of civil war within the Republican Party going on right now, which I think is a theme that holds. Rance Priebus, the chairman of the party at the time, right after in the days, really weeks after the election in 2012, he assembles this group of functionaries and he tells them, as you report, to do a kind of autopsy, to figure out what it is that had happened. And it's an interesting group of people that he gathers together, among them Ari Fleischer. It's also interesting that the range of people they talk to, they even talk to people like Howard Dean to get a sense of what it is had happened. Talk a little bit about this, because they go through these focus groups. I mean, they're really digging in and want to know what happened.
Yeah, I thought this was fascinating. I spent some time interviewing Ari Fleischer up in his office in kind of the Westchester suburbs above New York City. And it was interesting because he was, you know, now a little bit removed from this process. But him looking back on it, he basically told me about this process where you had a small group of people who party functionaries, you know, Ari Fleischer was probably the most high profile of them since he had been the White House press secretary for George W. Bush, of course. But it was all people who were kind of if not moderate, kind of moderate in temperament, right? Who view, you know, very kind of governance oriented and believed in responsibility and believed in, you know, a wider – widening the tent for the Republican Party. And what they did was – I mean, they really fanned out. I actually – the process, I think they deserve some credit for, because they didn't just, you know, hold a few focus groups and then, you know, churn out a memo. They traveled all over the country, held focus groups all over the country. They interviewed people in, you know, across party lines. Howard Dean, it was one. There were, you know, and it went, you know, all the way from far right figures to far left figures, basically asking the question they wanted to answer was, how can the Republican Party exist into the 21st century? How can we ensure that it doesn't go extinct or be marginalized to become kind of a regional party where it does well in the South, parts of the Midwest and Mountain West, but doesn't, you know, never can win another national election? And their conclusion that they came back to was they tried, first of all, not to make policy prescriptions, because they believed that if they made any if they, you know, came out with this report and said you need to change XYZ policies, it would be immediately dismissed, right? So instead they talked about tone, they talked about being more inclusive. The two policy issues they did get into were immigration. They actually said the party needs to embrace a I believe their word was compassionate immigration reform proposal. That was one, because they said there was no way the party will ever be able to win a substantial portion of Latino voters as long as they're viewed as the anti-immigrant, anti-immigration party. So that was one. The other one was same-sex marriage. They said the party doesn't have to, you know, embrace same-sex marriage necessarily, but it needs to open its doors to gay rights advocates, to people who are gay, people who want to get married to same-sex partners, and they need to be open to it and have a polite, friendly, agree-to-disagree kind of approach to that, if nothing else. And so those are kind of their findings. And of course, as soon as they released their report, they faced an immediate, noisy, intense backlash from the right wing.
Conservatives freaked out. Grassroots segments saw it as an attack on them. The religious right, of course, wasn't crazy about the idea of appealing to moderating a position on same-sex marriage. And then there's the argument, of course, that you hear from conservative commentators like, you know, Rush Limbaugh and Mark Levin and Ann Coulter, that the party doesn't, in fact, need to moderate its positions. It doesn't need to rebrand itself. In fact, what it needs to do is be even more conservative.
Right.
So would you just – do you think you understand that argument? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Because it seems
so counterintuitive, right? Yeah. It seems like and to probably a lot of people listening, and to a lot of people who are not very conservative voters, they would say that's an insane takeaway from the last several elections. I mean, yes, I do think I understand the argument. I tried as much as possible to understand where these people are coming from. The argument is essentially that the way Republicans can win elections, or way anyone wins elections, is when there's a very clear, stark choice between the two candidates, right? And so their argument is that John McCain in 2008, Mitt Romney in 2012 were trying too hard to appeal to the middle, trying too hard to moderate, so that what they essentially came off as was this is a term you hear them a lot of conservatives throw around, is Democrat light, that the Republicans were nominating a slightly less liberal Obama or a marginal, you know, a moderately less liberal Obama, but certainly not anyone who was providing a really dynamic, exciting, totally alternate vision. Now, you can argue with even that premise. You could certainly argue with the premise. You can also argue with the idea that Mitt Romney and John McCain necessarily ran very moderate campaigns. I don't know if that's necessarily true. Whatever their personal beliefs are, I think both of them got pulled pretty far to the right on a lot of key issues in the primaries. But the argument is that you need a stark choice, and that is long, and you know, this is one that Ted Cruz, I've heard him, you know, take buildings down with, you know, uproarious applause, whipping these ballrooms into frenzies by making this case basically to conservative voters, and they love hearing it because they believe that You know, Ronald Reagan was a perfect example of this, right? Ronald Reagan was a very conservative candidate, and the Republicans dominated him, and he won. That, of course, ignores the fact that the American demographics and American ideas about a lot of these issues has changed pretty dramatically since the 80s. But that is fundamentally the argument.
Let's talk about Ted Cruz. Of course, Cruz is the rare winner in 2012 in a night of Republican losses, as you point out. And of course, he is already looking forward to the presidency. Let me back into this section on Ted Cruz with something you write about Mike Lee, because I think it's interesting and obviously relevant to this place. He's the junior senator from Utah. You say that for all of Senator Lee's gifts, political theater isn't one of them. And you mentioned one particular speech that he delivers about the government shutdown. Full of passion in some ways, but it just really comes off as a dud. And I wanted to, in fact, just read this section from the book, because I think it's particularly interesting. You said that for all his policy savvy, Senator Mike Lee lacked gravitas. When he spoke in public, he had a habit of placing his hands just in front of his stomach and gently pressing his fingertips together in a pose that was reminiscent of a choir boy, or more fittingly, given his delivery, a mortician. His speech had gone entirely unnoticed, hardly an auspicious beginning to a campaign that was supposed to mark the permanent emergence of a Tea Party in Washington. For this to work, you write, it would have to be much more exciting. It would need to be an event, a performance. Enter Ted Cruz. So Mike Lee and Ted Cruz are of the same kind of disposition. They have shared ideology. Ted Cruz, and this is the crucial sort of insight you have about Ted Cruz. He knew what it was. He knew the theatrical part. He knew what spectacle was about.
Yes. And that is a key difference. I mean, what's interesting about this is that this is before the government shutdown actually happened. So this is like the summer of 2013.
Yeah.
There was this, you know, gathering of right-wing lawmakers and kind of right-wing leaders of conservative pressure groups that had gathered in Mike Lee's office to talk about this campaign to defund Obamacare. And Mike Lee was originally tapped as the senator lawmaker who was going to lead the charge, because he had positioned himself very well on these issues. He was very savvy about policy and healthcare and the various issues involved. And so he was supposed to be the leader. But after this speech and kind of his general lack of you know, theatrics, Ted Cruz basically steps in and steals the show.
Yeah.
And from my reporting, Mike Lee is actually kind of okay with that. Like, I don't think he necessarily wanted to, you know, be the guy traveling around the country, you know, delivering barn burner speeches. That's just not his nature. Ted Cruz, absolutely, that is his nature.
Yeah.
I write about, you know, go back into his earlier life. Ted Cruz is a guy who grew up from a very, very young age, having his father, who is a Cuban exile and a very, very, you know, intense man, would take his little boy onto his knee and tell him, God has destined you for greatness.
Yeah.
And he would repeat that over and over almost every day, according to some of my sources. And this was ingrained in Ted Cruz's kind of head from a very young age. Then you pair that with the fact that I write about how he never really was, you know, well-liked in middle school, high school, college, law school. He was always seen as arrogant and socially, you know, awkward or annoying. And so you kind of pair this outsider feeling, or this feeling of always, you know, being kind of socially rejected, with this belief in his own, you know, great destiny.
Yeah.
and he decides that he wants to, you know, it kind of creates the perfect storm of inside Cruz's psyche, where he is ready to take charge. And then he does understand the theatrics. He was a debater in college, I write about, a star national champion debater. He knows how to perform. He knows how to give speeches. He knows how to debate. And that kind of position him perfectly to be the Tea Party hero of the government shutdown.
I hadn't realized just how early this all started with Ted Cruz. I mean, not only his father, who told him these stories, as you mentioned, the high stakes stories and lofty themes, but you tell the story about when he was Senator Cruz was 13, and his father takes him to this man named Roland Story, who runs this conservative foundation for young people. I mean, he's 13 years old. He comes to be part of this. I got to ask you about this. This traveling troupe of patriotic performers. The Constitutional Corroborators.
I love the Constitutional Corroborators. That's my favorite name of any club ever. The Constitutional Corroborators.
What was that about?
So yeah, Roland Story is this guy. He's kind of a kindly older gentleman in Texas who he had actually had a history in an earlier career in vaudeville. So he's somebody who teaches Ted Cruz about performance. But what they would basically do, I mean, this group would, first of all, he would kind of teach these very young kids, you know, 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds, about some of the kind of key conservative thinkers and intellectuals and economists, and they would pore over the texts and learn about this stuff. And then as part of a performance, they would travel around to VFWs in the area and make these performances where they would basically memorize large portions of the Constitution and recite them and write them out. There was like this whole act that they had put together, and Ted Cruz was part of it. He was kind of one of the stars. Also, as part of their training in the Constitutional Corroborators, Roland Story would actually put together these. They would reenact kind of key scenes from like the Founding Fathers or the Constitutional Convention, and then cast the various kids as characters in those scenes. And Ted Cruz, according, you know, to people I talked to, always seemed just totally at home playing these like very huge roles in vastly important historical episodes. He was like very comfortable just standing in as John Adams or whatever. So that was kind of his very early kind of glimpse at what his future held.
Let's tell one more story about Ted Cruz, which this brings us up to sort of the modern role that he's playing, the role that he's playing right now in all of this. So Ted Cruz's role in the 14-day government shutdown, where he's determined to stop Obamacare. In your reporting, what you found is that the senator had this sense that, and maybe this goes back to what you write about early on, he understands in middle school and in college that people don't really like him. And in fact, he seems to be kind of okay with all of that because he sees a bigger picture for himself. And you report that Cruz has a sense that he knows this shutdown, or he has a sense of this anyway. It's not going to be good for the party, but it's going to go viral. It's going to be spectacle. So it will absolutely be good for his own fortunes. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're saying? That he's not really thinking about the bigger picture of the party right now. He's thinking about himself.
Yes, that is absolutely what I came away believing after talking to a lot of people, including, you know, I actually quote aides to Ted Cruz, including one during the guy who talked to me a few days into the government shutdown, kind of in a jarringly candid interview. I should say he requested anonymity to talk to me, but he actually said that Ted Cruz knows that we're not actually going to be able to defund Obamacare. That, you know, as much as we're talking about that, that's not going to happen. But we didn't go with a simpler message, or Senator Cruz didn't want to go with a simpler message because that wouldn't make for a good hashtag on Twitter. That's what the aide tells me. So that gives you a glimpse at the cynicism here. I mean, look, I approached all of these figures very empathetically, and like I said, I understand at a human level kind of what created this, but you know, created kind of the justification for Cruz to do this. But that said, I mean, I really, you know, I did a lot of reporting, and it's pretty clear to me that Cruz did not ever believe that defunding Obamacare was something that could happen as much as he claimed it would publicly. And that even beyond that, you know, he didn't particularly care whether the Republican Party was, you know, injured in the process. It turned him into a star, into a national star of the Tea Party. And that's what really mattered to him. And he's ridden that all the way into the current presidential cycle, where he is, you know, seems well positioned to, you know, to do well in Iowa and other early states.
He seems like a really good strategist. I mean, he seems to play the long game. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I should point out, you know, for those who aren't familiar, he actually is quite brilliant.
Yeah.
He went to Princeton. He went to Harvard Law School. He actually was a Supreme Court litigator. As Solicitor General of Texas, he argued several high-profile cases in the Supreme Court, widely recognized across the legal spectrum as a rising star and as a brilliant litigator. And yes, he has a very good strategic mind. I you know, you could say a lot of things about Ted Cruz. You cannot say that he's dumb. He is very engaged on the issues and politically savvy, and he knows what he's doing.
McKay Coppins is with us. His book is called The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. You can join us if you like, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll get to some of the other players in this story, Donald Trump among them, when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're kicking off the year with a conversation about presidential politics. It is an election year, after all. Political journalist McKay Coppins is joining us, and he says this is a crucial moment for the Republican Party. He's written a book that examines the party's effort to get the White House back. It's called The Wilderness. He's joining us from a studio in New York City. Well, I guess why should anyone be surprised at how the Donald Trump section in your book that that he goes off on you? Let's sort of talk about this. It in some ways, McKay Coppins, it seems like what you're saying about Donald Trump and his entrance in the race is that one of the reasons, maybe this is unfair to sort of simplify it like this, but it seems like one of the reasons he decides to run for president was that he perceived that people were kind of ignoring him. They weren't paying enough attention to him. And in some ways, getting into the race was an act of petulance almost.
I think that is fair to a point. I mean, I would say that it's not just that people weren't paying attention to him because, you know, he's still Donald Trump.
And, right.
You know, 2013, 2014, he was not lacking for attention necessarily, but he was lacking for attention from a certain type of people, right? Mm-hmm. He wanted you have to recall that in 2011 he was making a big fuss about possibly running for president and got a ton of attention because he was constantly spreading these kind of hysterical fevered conspiracy theories about Barack Obama's birth certificate, claiming that he wasn't actually born in the United States. Those have been disproven, but they still hold sway among a certain swath of the right wing. And Donald Trump was championing them, and he actually was getting a lot of traction with them. Now, he decides not to run. Although along the way, every major Republican candidate in 2012 showed up to Trump Tower to kind of kiss the ring and beg for his endorsement. He ends up endorsing Mitt Romney.
Right.
And then throughout that campaign, all through 2012, the Romney campaign gets increasingly frustrated with him because he's making outlandish demands. He's doing outlandish things that make Mitt Romney look bad. I was at the endorsement event in 2012, I believe it was February, at Trump's hotel in Las Vegas. And Mitt Romney could not have looked more uncomfortable up on that stage with him. I think he was up there for 5 minutes. Anyway, but by the end of that campaign, Trump is basically burned bridges with the entire Republican establishment. The Republican Party is tired of him. And the media is kind of tired of being jerked around by him because, as it turns out, and I write in the book, he had been kind of playing this same stunt for 25 years where he says, I'm thinking about running for president, gets a ton of attention, and then ends up not doing it, right?
Yeah.
So in the wake of 2012, he starts it up again and says, maybe I'll run in 2016. And no one's really paying that much attention anymore. No one's listening to him. And I write about this in the book, I actually just go up to New Hampshire for one of these political events where Donald Trump is speaking and trying to, you know, stoke 2016 buzz. And I had arranged with one of his aides to interview him on the way back to New York, because I actually just wanted to talk to him about, you know, why are you still continuing this, what I thought at the time was a charade?
Yeah.
You know, obviously fast forward to now, he that proved to be wrong. But I actually think that because so many in the political class and in the political media weren't giving him the respect he felt he was due, he kind of realized he was backed into a corner and felt like he had no other choice but to he had to do it, or no one would ever pay attention to him again. I'm not sure even he. I mean, I've talked to a couple people in his inner circle. I'm not even sure he thought he would be doing as well as he is now. But you know, things took off and he's enjoying it now.
Well, you tell about this encounter. As you mentioned, you were supposed to just fly back with him to New York, and because of weather, you guys end up going to Palm Beach, Florida, where he has this massive compound there. And so you sit there and entertain his sort of conspiracy theories about the birth certificate, and you interview him. And a few weeks later, in BuzzFeed News, you publish your story. And here's the headline: 36 hours on the fake campaign trail with Donald Trump. And Trump goes ballistic. Now, just we don't have to spend a lot of time. I mean, he calls you he goes after a lot of people. He calls you the slimebag reporter.
Right.
But then he starts to create this really what seems disconcerting personal attack on you, as aides start to say that you were there in Florida ogling women. And mm-hmm. I mean, he really went after you. And that has to have been a little not frightening almost, was it?
Well, there was one – I will say there was one moment where I actually felt – pretty, you know, unsettled. And it was, and it was in the context of him, you know, waging this like weeks-long Twitter battle and, you know, tweeting about me constantly, taking shots at my wife, having, you know, his various followers, you know, tweet about me that his these right-wing websites were planting or were running stories that were totally false about me. And all that, you know, like I would be lying if I didn't say it was at least a little bit fun, mm-hmm. although it was also, obnoxious at times. But the one unsettling moment came when, amid all of this, I was working in my apartment late one night, and I get this GChat message pops up from somebody who's a conservative opposition researcher, who that basically in politics is somebody whose job is to dig up dirt on the opposition, with the intent of, if not smearing them, but, you know, airing it, right? And this opposition researcher tells me that somebody has tried to recruit him to join a project where I was the target. They were supposed to dig into my life, try to find some kind of skeleton that would, quote unquote, finish me.
Wow.
And then he said, I didn't join this project, but I know there are others. And then I tried to get more details and he logged off. So I write in the book that after that happened, I started to become a little bit paranoid, and I was constantly found myself kind of looking around as I was walking down the street to see if I was being like tailed or whatever. And who knows what as far as I know, nothing came of it. But it does, I think, show a little bit about the, you know, first of all, how personally Donald Trump takes this stuff, and then how much further he's willing to go than anyone else in politics. And I think we've certainly seen that borne out again and again this past year.
I think some of the most, I have to say, interesting reporting was about the role of now House Speaker Paul Ryan. Mm-hmm. And some of the things I wanted to ask you a couple of things. When Mitt Romney was infamously recorded at this Boca Raton fundraiser griping about the 47% of people who would vote for, you know, President Obama no matter what, you talk about how Paul Ryan was livid, was furious about that moment. And one of the reasons is, you write, is that Ryan had been working on this big campaign address about poverty. It's a little bit like, as you say, Jack Kemp had done. And he kind of had to ditch it because he didn't want to be perceived as being insincere.
Right.
And this was a really interesting how Paul Ryan feels adrift in the campaign, frustrated, restless, and he really wants to appeal to the poor in the country. He has this – seems like this kind of epiphany about poverty.
Yeah. So up before he had been tapped to join the ticket, he had been writing kind of a series of idealistic memos to Mitt Romney, basically making the case, you know, Mitt, you need to make this, you know, lay out a really positive conservative vision that doesn't just target the middle class, you know, doesn't just help the middle class, which is where you think a lot of your voters are, but also extends to the poor and the marginalized people in our country. And Mitt Romney had said, thank you, you know, thanks, Paul, and then kind of set them aside. Because, you know, Romney's consultants believed that it was a political waste of time. It would take them off message. Hmm. Paul Ryan joins the campaign and really does become, you know, he sets out his mantra was, I write, what would WWPD, what wouldn't Palin do?
Right.
Meaning that he wants to not – he doesn't want to be the running mate who goes rogue or who makes it all about himself or, you know, complicates things for the nominee. He wants to just – you know, run the plays that Romney and his consultants call. And he does that, but he just starts to get increasingly frustrated because he feels like they're spending all their time in identical, you know, kind of swing state, middle class, upper middle class areas. And he wants to go into and talk to the poor. And so what's kind of sad and ironic is that the campaign had been kind of putting him off and dismissing him as he's been talking about this big campaign address about poverty. And then after the 47% video leaks, then they all of a sudden all the campaign staffers are very excited about the idea because they think it'll help them kind of walk back some of the damage that had been done. And so Ryan does end up giving a speech, and this is where the epiphany occurs. The compromise is you can give one speech in Cleveland, in a poor neighborhood, you know, kind of inner city neighborhood in Cleveland, and you can meet with some people who work with the poor, but you have to do it behind closed doors and it has to be off the record. And so he says, okay, fine. So before the speech, he goes into this, you know, kind of high-ceilinged room backstage and meets with ministers and you know, counselors at drug rehab facilities and halfway houses, and it's kind of this group that's been assembled to meet with him. And afterward, one of them asks, "Can we pray on you? Can we lay hands and pray on you?" And he jokes, "Well, I'm a Catholic, but yeah, sure, I'm cool with that." And they surround him and lay hands on him and pray on him and they basically ask that he'll have strength as he finishes the campaign and that he'll be able to really reach out to the poor and be, you know, have the vision that he needs to help the poor. And when they finish, he actually has tears in his eyes. And looking back after the campaign, especially in kind of the weeks and months after the campaign in 2012 after his defeat, Paul Ryan looks back in that moment and kind of decides it was the one, you know, moment of clarity he experienced the entire campaign and feels really called almost in a divine sense to use his prominence in the Republican Party and his conservative beliefs to find a really proactive conservative vision for how to address poverty. And my book kind of tells the story over the next couple years how he spends time pursuing that.
But this story is so packed with irony in that he has this kind of spiritual epiphany about dealing with the poor, which seems entirely Christian, but he's perceived within the campaign and really among evangelicals as not Christian enough. I mean, he was a good altar boy. He's a very good Catholic.
Right.
But it turns out he didn't really know much about those particulars of Christianity, at least not enough to appeal to evangelicals. And so his aides put together it was an 80-page playbook about
– Well, that was Rand Paul.
Rand Paul. That's right.
But that analysis is true. The Romney-Ryan ticket was the first ticket the Republican Party had ever had that didn't include a Protestant Christian.
Yeah.
It was a Mormon and a Catholic, and that mattered. The campaign was worried about it. But Rand Paul, this is one of the most fascinating stories I think in the book, is Rand Paul decides that he's Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, very libertarian. He wants to build this new coalition in the Republican Party to win the primary, and part of that is reaching out to evangelical Christians. But because he's not very well versed in kind of evangelical politics or evangelical religion, they assemble a team of Christian outreach advisors, who the leader of whom produces an 80-page memo laying out in very blunt clinical detail how Rand Paul can appeal to Christians. And this includes, you know, certain religious buzzwords that will make him sound more evangelical and, certain people that he needs to meet with and how to flatter them and how to court them. And this obviously this memo was kept under wraps. It was only shown to a few people. But the author of the memo, Doug Weed, who is a longtime kind of political operative in the Republican Party, described it to me and just basically said that Rand Paul followed it to a T, trying to court Christians. And it didn't totally work. And actually, I kind of think that there's something about that that's, you know, to find hope in because, you would like to believe that politicians – obviously, there's a lot of, you know, fake religious rhetoric, I think, that's kind of cynical in these campaigns. But you would like to think that somebody couldn't just follow a memo and turn himself into a different religion, right?
Yeah. Rand Paul is such an interesting figure because you talk about his early days in college as this sort of rabidly nonconformist figure, part of this crazy kind of hippie movement, and you spent a lot of time with that and that libertarian strain. And before we head to a break, I want you to say something about this. You write about Ron Paul, Rand Paul's father, obviously, and how he, as you put it in the book, sidelines his son's presidential ambitions. Now, I haven't read a lot about that. It seems like your book is one of the first to really kind of explore first, that. Yeah. Would you mention something about that before we?
Sure. Break? Well, just in that in the lead up to 2012, Ron Paul, the father of Rand, had run in 2008 as a protest candidate and told his kind of chief political advisor, Jesse Benton, that he wasn't going to run again in 2012, that he just wanted to kind of retire in peace and not go through the strain of another political campaign, national campaign. And so that advisor then goes to Rand and says, okay, Rand, well, I guess, Ron, your dad's not going to run. Do you want to do it? And this is ahead of 2012, not this election, last election.
Yeah.
Rand is all about it. He's very excited. They start to lay the groundwork. He does a political event in South Carolina that goes very well. And Rand Paul starts to build buzz about a 2012 presidential campaign. And amazingly, I found this remarkable. Just as Rand Paul is starting to get national attention for a potential presidential bid, that same political advisor gets a phone call from Ron Paul, who says, actually, I changed my mind. I do want to run in 2012. And the political advisor at least to him, it seems very clear that Ron did not talk to his son about this. He just made the decision, which effectively sidelined his son. And this is emblematic of an entire kind of strange but ultimately, I think, human father-son rivalry between Ron and Rand Paul that does have political ramifications that extend into today.
McKay Coppins is with us. His book is The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. We need to take another quick break, but we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with McKay Coppins. He's a senior political writer at BuzzFeed News. He has a new book called The Wilderness, an exploration of the Republican Party's quest to get back to the White House. Let's do a lightning round because we have so many figures we're not going to be able to get to. Let's talk about Mitt Romney because it looks as though Mitt Romney was going to sort of settle into the role of a political martyr, you say. But as you write in the book, something strange happened on his way to martyrdom. Americans started to like him again and even miss him. This is an interesting part. I mean, we all know that Romney tries to jump back in and he sort of backs out. But some of the details you reveal was just how maybe vicious is not a fair word, but how aggressive Jeb Bush's campaign is to stop a Mitt Romney run.
Right.
If you would talk about that and also talk about how Romney's supporters are still sort of looking for Mitt Romney to sort of sweep in eventually.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, after Romney decides, he decides that he wants to consider it again, consider running in 2016. This is in basically December, January of this year, or of last year.
Right.
And he starts actively, openly, publicly flirting with the idea, giving speeches, calling fundraisers, donors. And to a remarkable extent, the Jeb Bush juggernaut, his campaign or team was known at the time, really went out of their way to gobble up all the donors that Mitt Romney had relied on in past campaigns, higher up consultants who had been close to him, and even started getting, certain prominent conservative pundits to write columns and stories kind of dismissing the idea of a Romney 2016 bid. And Romney and his inner circle really were just livid at Jeb Bush. Or at least I should say Romney's loyalists were livid at Jeb Bush. Right. Romney was sort of just beaten down by the end of the process and was sort of reminded over this kind of month or two of how brutal these campaigns can be, and kind of feels like he doesn't want to bring his family back into it and put them through another one of these brutal campaigns. But that said, I report in my book that the people very close to Romney and including wealthy fundraisers and loyalists and people who know the Romney family very well have continued to hope that that Romney could come back into the race, even at this point. And what they've actually done is they've continued to huddle and talk, and they've laid out a kind of late stage scenario strategy where Romney could be drafted from the convention floor in Cleveland this July. And I laugh because it seems so far fetched, but honestly, I don't think anyone saw the Donald Trump phenomenon growing as big as it has. And people, I still check in with them, and they say, if we get to the point in 2016, in July of 2016, where Donald Trump looks like he's poised to be the Republican Party's nominee, we're going to put this strategy into place and try to draft him from the convention floor. So, any diehard Romney fans listening can, I guess, hold out hope that that's possible. Though Romney himself has said that he's not interested and has tried to kind of push those stories away.
Yeah, but you did say that he inserts this little rhetorical wiggle room into his statement that he was backing out. He did sort of leave that. And I think Romney supporters or people who love that scenario of Romney sweeping in have got to be loving what's going on right now, because you have Rand Paul, and the libertarian strain doesn't seem to be getting any traction right now. Marco Rubio as a sort of not quite an establishment figure, but sort of there, certainly would appeal to Latinos. The party loved that idea. He doesn't seem to be capturing anyone's attention necessarily right now. You have Jeb Bush, obviously, isn't this sort of conventional establishment candidate, doesn't seem to be getting any traction right now. What do you make of what is going on right now, where you have people like Ted Cruz, sort of these outliers, these I don't think that's unfair to say, and Donald Trump catching people's attention right now?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, I think that one of the things this book does is it lays out, and certainly while I look back at it now, it does kind of tell the story of how the party got to this point. I mean, look, the in 2012 – because there was no kind of heir apparent, there really was sort of a vacuum of leadership in the party. And so you have this enormous kind of unruly cast of characters who emerges to try to take hold of the GOP. And it actually leads to this cycle has produced the largest Republican presidential field in history. And there's a reason for that, right? The two things that are going on are, one, that there are so many factions in the party, from libertarians to social conservatives to various elements of the establishment to Tea Party, who all have their own kind of candidate who serves as an avatar for their group and their interests, and none of them seems especially willing to compromise and join together and create kind of a consensus coalition that would, elevate their standard bearer. So in that leadership vacuum, you have it creates the ability for a figure like Donald Trump to come in, who has unmatched resources, unmatched star power, celebrity power, to kind of come in and dominate the race. The other thing that's happening is that people are, and this is you see this time and time again throughout the narrative of the book and just in the news, people are genuinely so tired of the political establishment. Yeah. And they're fed up with politics. I mean, this is happening on the left too. There's a reason Bernie Sanders, yeah, a socialist from Vermont, is surging, right? Mm. Or doing so well, because people felt like, you know, Barack Obama was going to come in and fix things, and you know, a lot of the same stuff has happened. So I think that there's this attitude of just being fed up with the government and with the establishment, and that's also contributing to Trump's rise.
I've had a few questions come in from listeners. One of them comes from AE, who writes about this polling that shows white men are among the angriest Americans, and that they tend to be Donald Trump's natural constituency. And the question is kind of an interesting segue into what's going on up in Oregon, because AE writes, should we expect to see more incidents like the militia standoff in Oregon as, you know, political statements by angry white men? What do you make of that? And for those who aren't aware, over the weekend there was this armed group of right-wing, I suppose is fair to say, who took over this headquarters of a wildlife refuge outside of Burns, Oregon. They're this anti-government group. Two sons of the Nevada rancher Clive and Bundy are up there. Now, you've looked at these kinds of things. Maybe that's a weird transition to talk about Donald Trump and what's going up and going on in Burns, Oregon. But what do you make of that?
Well, yeah, I don't think – I mean, you can't blame Donald Trump individually for what's happening in Burns, Oregon. But what Donald Trump has done is tapped into the same sentiment that's animating demonstrations, protests, whatever you want to call those, what's happening in Oregon. I mean, some people say it's full on, you know, terrorism. These are domestic terrorists. At least one of them was armed, as far as the last news report I saw.
Yeah.
I think the listener made a good point in that Donald Trump, actually, if you look at his, you might assume that he would have most appeal to the most right wing voters, the most conservative voters. That's not actually true. His biggest constituency is more about demographics. White male, working class, and middle class are where he gets the most support. And I think what he's done is tapped into a lot of economic anxiety, a lot of frustrations with the economic recovery that's been much slower than planned, and you know, the changing demographics in this country. I think, not to make light of the situation, but Donald Trump is a lot of, you know, he sounds a lot of the time like a sort of Archie Bunker character. Mm-hmm. He's repeating very kind of outmoded, outdated, now considered politically incorrect ideas, but his core constituency loves it. And I think what's happening in Oregon is different, but you're still seeing – it's the same, you know, anger, anxiety, and anti-government sentiment that's animated the Tea Party, that's animated Trump's constituency, that is driving these people. And the Republican Party has to deal with that. And it's a current in the party. And, you know, I just saw right before I came on, Marco Rubio commented on it and said, you know, that these people can't be lawless. They have to follow the law. The more candidates like that who are willing to stand up and face that element of the party, I think the better off the party will be going into the future.
It's McKay Coppins, senior political writer at BuzzFeed News. His new book is The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. He joined us from New York. McKay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.